Slash my tires out there. Yeah, we can figure that out. I've never had that one as an introduction before, you know. I moved to Dallas. I expected my tires to get slashed, but for another reason on that. Well, good to see everybody again. Thank you, Brandt family. What a blessing it is to hear all of you. That was worth the trip on that three wonderful, delightful daughters. Got a chance to talk with them a little bit, figure out what they're thinking about, what they might want to do when they graduate and stuff. So that's really, really good. New paradigms. Nobody likes them. Everybody likes what you're used to and used to your explanations. And even if amongst creationists, we have our favorite answers to questions already down. But sometimes they even need to be updated because our understanding of things biblically may not have been totally right, and we also get new scientific information. So tonight we're going to talk about adaptation. Adaptation in terms of creation science is the name of the game. You're adaptable. Everybody knows that. Some of you are less adaptable than you used to be, but you are still adaptable. And if organisms could not adapt, if you were as static as that chair that you're sitting on, one, you wouldn't live very long in a environment that is adaptable. But two, you could never get a theory of evolution going. But because organisms can change, then you can get a theory going, because then you can imagine or extrapolate that they can change quite a bit. But adaptation is a spectrum. That's one of the new things we need to get in our mind. If I were to suddenly, from behind the pulpit here, shoot a gun, bang, many of you would jump on that, and some of you would pull a gun out and shoot me. But anyway, probably from across the room, that would be the end of me. I wouldn't have to worry about my tires getting slashed. But I know I would be in heaven. But your heart rate would immediately jump. You'd have this big shot of adrenaline, and boom, as I was mentioning to Pastor, you'd be ready to fight or flight. You'd be on your way. That's an adaptation. That's a very fast adaptation. Happens within, I guess if I turn my head, I'm not that adaptable. So you would immediately be ready to fight or flight. And then if I were to take you, as I mentioned to Pastor, up to, I'm going to push this, see if my thing is going to move. If I don't do that every second, then it'll tend to go to sleep on me. But if I were to take you to Pikes Peak, where the altitude's way up there, some of you would be short of breath. Most of you probably short of breath for a little bit. And within a couple weeks, you would adapt. Your body would sense the change in the atmospheric oxygen. A signal would be sent to the glands right above your kidneys, and you would be turning out a chemical that would cause the number of red blood cells in your body to go up. You'd be able to carry more oxygen. You'd adapt. And for some of you, we would be sensing some changes. Some people can even sense changes. All of us really can. And you can actually pass on data to your offspring. It can be passed on through your germ cells. That's an egg or sperm. And nobody thought that could happen. But you can sense things, and it can put markers on the DNA in your egg or sperm, and it can change your children in one generation. Or as little baby is developing inside mom's womb, mom can be acting like a sensor for things around her. And data is passed on. Mom cannot change the baby. Baby makes itself inside of mom's body. Sorry, gals, you don't really build a baby. Baby builds itself inside of you, and baby will adjust to those things. So adaptation is a spectrum. It's a lifelong thing, and it's something you can even pass on to your children. Nobody really knew this. Nobody knew a lot of these things until the last 20 years. So they all need to be incorporated into our explanation of adaptation. So what organisms seem to be able to do is they seem to be able to clearly sense what's happening and what's changing in their environment. And they seem to be able to track those changes. And they seem to be able to adjust appropriately. Now, whenever I was here, two or three years ago, I did multiple talks on how organisms change. And I know that some of you took diligent notes, and you remember that I said that the mechanisms that organisms use to adapt, I used four words, they all began with an R, are highly regulated. They're usually very rapid. Sometimes they're even reversible and repeatable. And they have responses that are so targeted they can even be predictable. So if we were to go to a scientific conference, we're all going to go to a scientific conference, you would see a whole room with these things on the wall. They're scientific posters. And creationists have their own scientific conference. And I brought this poster. And I stuck the poster up. And then they have a poster session where people come around and they walk around the room and they look at everybody's poster. And you give like a 5 or 10 minute little pitch on your poster. You should be so lucky tonight that it would be 10 minutes. It won't. But so this will be a further explanation of if you came to this talk and you looked at this poster. Now, we'll be able to move in. I know that some of you can't read everything on that very well. Some of you with more highly evolved peepers can, but others can't. But let's say that I said, now look really close. Oh, look at that. Jumped right up. Continuous environmental tracking. Everybody wants to know the name of what you're talking about. So this process we're going to call continuous environmental tracking. You know, organisms are tracking the environment continuously. That's putting it backwards. That's what organisms are doing. And you notice it says on the poster, this is a design-based perspective. Completely opposite of what evolutionists say. This one's design-based, and more important, it's organism-focused. It is not environment-focused. It's looking at the organisms. So it's organism-focused and design-based, and it's going to explain how creatures have adapted since the very beginning of creation. Most often creationists are talking about the fact that we live in a post-fall world, and we do. But even before there was a fall, organisms needed to adapt because the environment was a dynamic place. How do we know that? Well, we read in our Bibles that God made the stars and the sun and the moon to mark signs and what? Seasons. Seasons. And that looks like we're going through a seasonal change out there right now, outside. Now, if you're living on a planet that's got seasons, is it static or dynamic? It's dynamic. It's changing. The seasons cause it to change. In addition, he told organisms to be fruitful, multiply, and what? Fill the earth. Fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Now, if I am following that mandate, and I move into your space, I have filled the earth and I've moved into your space, have I changed your space for you? The answer is what? Yes, for the better, of course. But it's changed. It's changed. So whenever organisms are just moving in and out, they're changing the environment on all of those kinds of things. And in addition to that, the earth is spinning because it says there was day and night, day and night, day and night, or night and day. So we have indications that the earth was always a dynamic place. And organisms were going to fill those various niches. Now, as organisms fill the niches and they move from one place to another, it is demonstrating the incredible engineering genius of the Lord Jesus Christ. Not that just he exists, but that he is an engineering genius beyond compare. Humans do some pretty cool things, but the things that the Lord does makes ours look pretty simple in comparison. Ours are not cruddy. Ours are pretty impressive. They're flying a little robot around on Mars. Is that pretty impressive? That's impressive. But not nearly as impressive as the stuff that the Lord does. So it shows his engineering genius. But on top of that, it shows his wisdom. He's able to solve multiple problems simultaneously to the best that each one of them could be solved. So you need something to be strong but light. Fast but powerful. He's able to solve all of those kinds of things. And when organisms can move from one environment to the next, to the next, to the next, and they adapt, and not only do they survive, but they thrive, It's showing his, he's like showing off his engineering genius when he does that. And Adam and Eve could see that right from the beginning, and they could see this wonderful revelation of the Lord where they would glorify him for what he has done. And that's what this revelation, that's what the creatures are supposed to do, is demonstrate all of that. All of that was designed. If I were to ask you, look at your body and look at it very carefully, what part on it was not designed? Some of you might say, well, this one certainly doesn't look designed, but others would say nothing. Everything's designed. Everything is designed, right down to the cellular level. It's all designed. That's why I have a design-based perspective. All right, this is in total contrast to what we've been taught. The evolutionary paradigm that I was taught, and I didn't even recognize what I was being taught for many, many years, is not design-based, that was clear, but it wasn't organism-focused. It's environment-focused. In their worldview, and this is what Darwin changed, he doesn't focus on the ability of the organisms and how they change, because that shouts design too much. He looks at the environment as if the environment is changing the organisms, and organisms are passive modeling clay in the hands of the environment. That's why you'll see, and I've got hundreds of these screenshots, like this one from the magazine, the scientific journal, Nature. Evolution, geology, and climate drive diversification. They see environmental changes as pressures. Pressures that mold the organisms, mold them and shape them. And they've got causality 180 degrees backwards. Organisms are changing themselves. They are not being changed by. That sounds like a little subtle change, but it's very different. If you change yourself is one thing. If I change you, it's another. Causality flips from the organism to the environment. So in their view, when the environment changes, it's forcing you to change. And you know how it forces you to change? It doesn't force you individually, it forces a population in their view. Because when the environment changes in their view, and this is not right, the vast majority of you, if it changes severe enough, are going to what? Die. Die. Which means there'll only be one person left in this room to survive, the fittest. And who's that? Me. Of course, that's obvious. Ask my wife. So she'd say, I'd survive, don't you know? Well, first of all, does that make any sense? When's the last time you saw a whole herd of horses? You know, aside from something just kills them, like we had a big snowstorm a few years, killed a lot of horses. They don't all die. They all live. I've never seen them wipe out. On that. In addition to that, if you reduce the population down to one or just a few, that really puts the population at big risk of going extinct. Extinct. So the whole concept makes no sense. Makes no sense. But in their worldview, geology, climate, and other factors have to drive diversification. Organisms can't drive themselves. So they see changing environments drive organisms up a fitness landscape. I'm going to argue that is 100% wrong. That organisms are not passive modeling clay. They are highly sophisticated, autonomous things. What you see there on the screen is a drawing of a ship that really exists. It is an unmanned submarine hunter. It's actually a large ship. It's as long as this building is here. And on the ship, as it says here, it's going to prowl the world's oceans searching for submarines. A new vessel will patrol the world's oceans, hunting and tracking enemy submarines, and it'll execute its mission without a single human on board. So, what do you think this submarine tracker has to have on board? If it's not going to have a human, it has to have loads of what? Computers? You think it's got a lot of computers? Yeah. And it's got to have a lot of data stored on it about all kinds of submarines. So it's got to have computers. It's got to have data. How in the world does it know where the submarines are? It's got to have what? Sensors? What kind of sensors? Sonar? Do you think it's got a heat sensor? Yeah, probably does. Highly sophisticated. You think the submarines put off a little heat? Sound sensors? Sonar? Probably things that can sniff stuff that are coming off of the submarines. All kinds of sensors, chemical sensors, and then it has to be able to react. Do you think it carries weapons? Sure, it carries weapons, and it's going to deploy those weapons. So it's got to be highly sophisticated. If you were the engineer that had to design these things, you would immediately see, wow, it has a whole bunch of things to patrol the oceans. For the next level tracking, the vessel will be armed with state-of-the-art what? Sensors, allowing it to detect the quietest of enemy subs. The idea is that it will be nearly impossible for a hostile sub to slip the unmanned vessel when it's on its tail. In other words, once it's locked onto you, you're a goner on that. It's worse than being tracked down by a starship or something like that. All those things. That's what you are. You're not out here to destroy something like this, but you are like this unmanned vessel. The Lord made you as an autonomous thing, and He put on you sophisticated state-of-the-art sensors. He put in you state-of-the-art computing systems. He put in you state-of-the-art responses to all of these things. Just like this ship needs fuel, you need fuel, but once I fuel you up, you can go off. That is what you are. You're these highly sophisticated things that can go out and search for things. So we're going to ask a question, and this is what you would do in a scientific study. We have to ask a question. Does the data indicate that organismal form, in other words, what organisms look like, is it externally imposed on them over time by fluctuating environmental changes? That's what evolutionists say. So that's the question. Does the data support that? Or does the data indicate that organisms are like these drones, which drive themselves through time, continually tracking dynamic environments while making suitable changes to their own form by internal means? You see, these are 180 degree opposite in terms of causality and what they're doing. Well, My hypothesis is that organisms have this internal form. My hypothesis is that they're tracking environmental changes. This is how science is done. It looks like they're tracking environmental changes. I suspect they're tracking environmental changes. Well, how are they tracking environmental changes? Well, since they're designed, I'm going to look to something that humans have designed that can also track changes, and those are called tracking systems. Tracking systems. So then you study, what does a human tracking system have? Well, human tracking systems have sensors to know what's happening around them. They have logic. That's what the computers have. When you detect this, then do this. If you detect this, then do this. It's got logic that says do these things when you detect that, and it has output responses, and some of them even have clocks built in them. In other words, if you want a rendezvous with something, you've got to have a clock. Boom, it's going to put you there right on time. But the three minimums are sensors, logic, and output responses. I'm going to hypothesize that organisms do the same thing, and they're going to use these same things. So this is what you have. This is a sun tracker right here, and it can track the sun and keep this thing aimed at the sun, and it's got a sun sensor. And then, it sends it right to a computer way down over here, some logic sensor, and then it puts a response out to these little motors. And the motors turn the thing and keep it locked onto the sun. Do you have those kinds of things? Yes, in spades, right down to the cellular level. And this is a picture of a cell right here. Of course, they have the environmental stress driving everything. How about if we change those not to lightning bolts, but they're just there? How about a plus or a minus? Meaning the environmental condition is either there or it isn't. It's not like this lightning bolt, which is changing thing. And then these little drawings are all different kind of sensors right on a cell membrane. And when they detect what's out there, they start to send data in through all different kind of mechanisms, and it's already being processed even before it gets to the nucleus where the DNA is. It's being processed en route. Logic is happening en route. And then when it gets to the nucleus, it can change the response of the DNA and then your cell's response. Do you know how many of these little sensors you have on a single cell? Thousands. Thousands. Tens of thousands on a single cell. And then these cells make up organs, and organs use sensors. And then those organs make up systems. They have sensors, and then you've got them all over your body. So from your body to your cells, you have these sensors, you've got the logic, and you've got the output. Through and through, are they being used to track environmental changes? The answer is yes. We're going to look at a bunch of examples that are going to look at organisms from the parents' generation, that means F0 to the parents, to the first generation and generations following. I'm going to take it through time, and I'm going to see, do the parents change? Do the offspring change? Do the grandchildren change? We're going to follow them through time, and we're going to look at what they're sensing in the environment with what sensor they have. Is this interesting? We're going to look at what they're tracking and how they're tracking it, and then we're going to look at how they adjust. And I'm going to show you pictures or drawings right from the scientific literature of how this happens. So, and then we'll just take it right from the top. Cell Metabolism. This is one of the leading scientific journals. You don't have to read all these headlines. I put this in because I do this lecture for non-believers and others. And they want to make sure that we're really doing good science. Gut commensal E. coli proteins, blah, 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 blah. All right, what that is saying is this. Okay, we'll just cut to the picture. This explains it. This is like a picture inside your intestine. So make sure you're shrunk down small, you're inside your intestine. These are the pictures of cells in your intestine. The cells on the intestine have all these finger-like projections on them. They increase the surface area so you can absorb all the nutrients from the good, healthy food that you're eating on that. And so you're living inside. Here's each side of your intestine from the side to side. This person eats a bit of food. This is going to demonstrate how you work together with other organisms. This is kind of cool. They eat the food. Boop, gets into the intestine. You have this number of these bacteria. They're called E. coli living in your gut. But within a few minutes, a few minutes of eating, the population of those E. coli explodes. They double, and they produce a whole bunch. And anyway, they produce all kinds of chemicals, which they release, and these chemicals are absorbed by the cells in your intestine, right there. And then when they absorb those chemicals, the intestine produces, the cells in the intestine produce other chemicals. Some of these chemicals are absorbed right from your gut. This is a picture of a blood vessel. They're dumped into your blood vessel. They come back. They go back to your brain. And they make your brain. They give the feeling of being full. And you stop eating, hopefully, on that. I know we all stop the moment we start to feel full. Yeah, I know. But it works. You get the feeling of feeling full. Now, isn't that fascinating? What's making the initial chemical to start to make you feel full? It's not the cells in your gut. It's the bacteria which are making chemicals which go into your bloodstream, which go back to your brain, which says you're full, stop eating. That's quite remarkable. It shows that you work together right from those bacteria. That means the Lord made this system where you're working together with your bacteria in your gut right from the very beginning of creation. Adam had this. Eve had this. They had this right from the beginning. And this is a very complex pathway that does it. And your body, in your intestine, can detect these signals. It detects them, it sends it back, you respond, and hopefully you stop eating. Wow. Well, here's another one. This is an easy one. Humidity sensing in fly. Drosophila is a fly. These flies are obviously going to sense relative humidity. Why? Because certain flies like to live at different humidity levels. Some like it drier, some like it wetter. Well, how in the world do they know whether it's dry or wet? Nobody knew until they actually took pictures. And at the base of this fly antenna, This is already drawn really big. This is at the base of it. They have tiny little single cells, the tips of individual nerves right here at the base in a tiny little pocket inside of the base of this antennae. And each of them is an individual nerve, and there's three nerves paired together which sense cold, moisture, and dryness, and they integrate all of that data, and that gives them what the relative humidity is wherever they are. Wow. Three individual nerves on both sides tell them what the relative humidity is. This is the world's smallest humidity sensor right there that humans have made. Fits on a quarter. That's pretty small. But these fit on the head of a pin. And that's what the Lord Jesus made in order for them to track what relative humidity is. I mean, that is really, really cool. And they are able to track those changes just with that. Oh, here's another one. Avian salt gland, a model for the study of membrane biogenesis. Biogenesis means something is brought into existence. Bio, biological thing, genesis, generated. It's a salt gland that these birds have. Now, these are seagulls here, and they're able to track the sodium concentration in their blood plasma. So if they're able to track the sodium concentration, because if they live near salt water, they're going to get salt water in, which is going to increase their sodium, they must have a sodium what? Sensor. It's a sensor that is specific for sodium, and they have it. It's actually located right by their heart. So they have this sodium sensor, and this is what happens. This seagull, if this seagull was living here, do you guys have seagulls up here?
Yeah.
Sure, we do. I asked people in Texas, do they have seagulls in South Dakota, where I'm from? No. On that, but there's seagulls flying around here all the time. And so let's say we had one of these Wyoming seagulls that wanted to go south for the winter, you know? So it's going to fly to Houston. Big mistake. Anyway, it makes the trek. It'll only do it one time, and then it'll adapt. So it flies down to Houston. And it starts living by the Gulf of Mexico, brackish water, salt water. When they begin to drink that water, what happens to the sodium concentration in their blood? It goes up. It goes up. That sensor detects it, and this gland right here, which is not here up in Wyoming, it forms de novo from scratch. It forms a gland from scratch, and any of you who have had histology, when you look through the inside of the gland, these are the blood vessels here, what would that look like to you? Kind of looks like the inside of a kidney, which processes the sodium in your body and secretes it right through your ureters and through your urine. It forms a gland from scratch, and it filters out the sodium, and it dumps it through a little pore right up here on their beak, and out it goes. So that they can adapt rapidly from going from an environment without salty water to salty water. And if they came to their senses and they migrated back to Wyoming, what do you think happens to the gland? It goes away. It goes away. That's quite cool. Enabling these organisms to rapidly change and adapt. Now you notice, I had on the slide right before this, some people will erroneously say salt water triggers the salt gland. In fact, a lot of creationists say something like that. Why did I put that big scraggly little X through it? Because it doesn't trigger it. Now you're thinking, wait a second, it does trigger it. No, it doesn't trigger it. The salt water is either there or it isn't. It's either there or it's not. It's a variable. And somebody, the Lord Jesus, designed a sensor in the bird that says, when you detect it, make the salt gland. So what triggers the salt gland? The bird triggers his own salt gland. That's how it happens. The salt water is either there or it's not. It's just a variable. The bird detects it, and the bird's body makes its own salt gland. All right, here's another one. Altitude adaptation in Tibetans caused by introgression of Denisovan-like DNA. What in the world is that about? Well, at the beginning of the talk, I mentioned if I took you up to the top of Pikes Peak, you would acclimate and you would begin to live up there because your body would start to make more red blood cells. The trouble is you can't get up there and live up there for a really long time, because when you make more blood cells in your bloodstream, your blood gets thicker and the viscosity of your blood goes up, and it makes it harder for your heart to pump, and it will put you into heart failure. Yet these people here, these Tibetans, they live up 15,000 feet, but they're not in heart failure. That's because they change and they adapt to these altitudes not by making more red blood cells. They adapt by having the hemoglobin in their red blood cells carry more oxygen per red blood cell. Therefore, they don't make more red blood cells. They carry more oxygen in the red blood cells that they have. Now, that's kind of cool. They have genetics for that. They have genetics for it, and a group of people in China have it, and nobody else on this planet that they've tested has it except for a small group that live in the Andes. But you don't have it. I don't have it. And they found fossils of human beings that lived after the flood. They're called Denisovans. There was at least three groups. So there's people like us, there's the Neanderthals, and there's the Denisovans. And they've sequenced the DNA of the Denisovans, and they have the genetics for this, even though they're extinct. They have the genetics for this. So these people were descendants of those people. And they're able to sense oxygen partial pressure, and as I mentioned, they're able to sense it in their body and pass on information. And this is what the paper said. We are now also starting to understand that adaptation to local environments may have been facilitated by gene flow from other hominins that may already have been adapted to those environments. That means there were other people who were their ancestors who were already adapted. Who were the ancestors of these ancestors, biblically speaking? The sons of Noah. It was from the sons of Noah that it says, the Bible says, the whole earth was populated. So that means at least one of the how many sons of Noah? Three. At least one of the three sons of Noah, or the daughter-in-laws, had this DNA. And it was passed on to these people, which enables them to live at these high altitudes. In other words, these people are fruitful, multiply, and they do what? Fill the earth. Does that include people living at low altitudes? Yes. Does it include people living at high altitudes? Yes. Does this give them unlimited ability to live at low oxygen pressures? No. You can't fly them up to 30,000 feet, 40,000 feet, and have them live. They'll die. So that demonstrates that when the Lord designed us, he designed us to be adaptable within a range. Those are called design parameters. We operate within the parameters. But when you get outside of the parameters, you will break. You'll break. Just like any design thing will break. You try to pull your truck, more stuff with the truck than it's designed to, it's going to what? It's going to break. So that's what happens. So that's, we're illustrating a lot of things by all these examples. Oh, here's a cool one. Mom knows best. The universality of maternal microbial transmission. Maternal microbial transmission. Well, you can figure that out. Maternal means what? Mom. And she's transmitting what? Microbes. She's transmitting microbes. Do you remember yesterday I mentioned how your appendix is like a little sensor sensing what? What's going by in your intestine? And I said it sends signals so that you can adjust the types and numbers of bacteria in your gut that are matched to your diet. And so when you're eating a diet here in Wyoming, you have a microbial spread which is suitable to the general diet that you're eating here. But if I were to take you to California and you were to start eating like a Californian diet, such as what? Sprouts or something like that, all those kinds of things, you know, fill up on some sprouts or better yet, some kale or something like that. You could eat some sprouts and kale. Oh, man. I got a drink on that. Oh, that's just enough to drive me crazy. Within 24 hours, the microbes in your gut would start to change. They would start to change. So mom, she's eating a diet. She's breastfeeding the baby. But after a while, that's going to stop, and baby's going to start eating a diet, very similar to mom's. So how do you get baby's bacteria in its gut adjusted to the diet that mom is eventually going to feed this baby once breastfeeding stops? Well, mom's going to transfer microbes to the baby, and she's going to do it through breastfeeding. And this is really quite remarkable. Anyway, the target is these circulating cells in your so-called immune system, which are going to be looking for a sensor for this cell adhesion molecule. All right, let me just explain what's really happening here. We're back to the gut again. So here's the cells. Remember, they have those little finger-like projections. This is the cells, and these are the bacteria inside of your gut. There's a cell which is mobile. It can move around. It's called an antigen-presenting cell. It can reach out long tentacles between the cells, grab a bacterium. I don't know if it can grab two, but I know it grabs at least one. It engulfs it. And it carries it. It doesn't kill it. It's like a hostage. It takes this live bacteria hostage, and it transfers it to a lymph node that's living around your gut. That's why they're called mesenteric lymph nodes. And it releases the bacteria inside the lymph node alive. The lymph node detects it, and then it sends signals back to the gut to kill some of these bacteria or let other ones grow, and it's adjusting the microbes in your gut by capturing a live bacteria whole and presenting it. Now, that's kind of cool in and of itself. Now, how does it know to make its way to the lymph node? I mean, it grabs a bacteria, and it transfers to the lymph node because there's a molecule on the lymph node which this cell can detect. It's like a homing beacon. Boom, 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 and the cell migrates to the beacon on the lymph node and presents the bacteria alive. Are you all following me? This is kind of cool. And that beacon is on that lymph node, only on the lymph node, except when mom is breastfeeding. And then that molecule appears up on the ductal tissue on mom's breast tissue. And so those cells home in on the lymph node, but they also home in on the duct tissue on mom's breast tissue, which is making breast milk. And it releases a live bacterium into the lymph node, but it also releases a live bacteria into the breast milk. Now that is cool. And then it gets absorbed into the breast milk, baby eats the breast milk, and it seeds baby's gut with those bacteria. Wow. Is the Lord a genius? I mean, that is just really, really cool. So baby, you know, this is it. You got a bacteria it's alive inside of mom's gut, and a few minutes later, it's in baby's gut. Alive. It's better than a transporter. You know, it's like, beam me up and put me down into a new place. Now, that's really kind of cool. So from an adaptation standpoint, what's happening? Let's explain this in terms of adaptation. Mom adapts herself to her environment, and that's generation number one. Generation number two, she's getting baby prepared to be adapted to the same environment that she's living in. Wow. That's what's happening in terms of adaptation. This is what the paper said. Here's a little bit of jargon here. The consequences of enteromammary trafficking. What's entero mean? Your gut, mammary glands, gut mammary trafficking includes the release of dendritic cells containing live maternal gut bacteria and some other antibodies specific for maternal gut bacteria into the colostrum and breast milk. Ready for baby. Wow, that's a cool way to transfer something from one generation to the next. Well, here's another one. I might have talked about this the last time I was here. If I didn't, then it's new. If I did, then you've probably forgotten. Look what it says. Paternal intergenerational epigenetic response to heat exposure in wild male guinea pigs. Does that ring a bell with anybody? No? All right. Well, the layman's headline says what? Guinea pigs beat climate change by tweaking. Oh, they got it right. They got it exactly right. By tweaking their own DNA. Your DNA is not static. You think you got your DNA? No, it isn't static. It's dynamic. There are little machines which can change it. They can change it in real time. So in this particular case, they took five. They want to know what's going to happen with climate change. A lot of these experiments are dealing with climate change. Are these animals going to make it through climate change or not? So they want to know if these guinea pigs are going to do it or not. So they took five male guinea pigs, and they put them in cages, and they stuck a heating pad in the bottom of the cage, and they cranked up the heat to match what they think is going to happen with man-made climate change. Okay. You don't have to be a guinea pig doctor to kind of understand male guinea pig anatomy. What's down there on the heating pad? All right, you got it figured out. So they cranked it up, and they're roasting them for 70 days. 70 days. That's worse than 40 days and 40 nights. Anyway, well, why do they do it for 70 days? Because it takes 70 days to make a cycle of sperm. They start out as a stem cell, and 70 days later, they're a functioning swimming sperm on that. So they do it for 70 days in order to get a crop of sperm. Then they take these male guinea pigs. They mate them with female guinea pigs, which have not been cooked. They've been living normally, normal lives. And she has pups. And they start looking at the DNA of the pups and the dads. And there are markers that were placed on the DNA which changes the expression of specific genes, and these genes are specific for temperature regulation, which enables dad and the pups to live at higher temperatures because they change the way they metabolize things and work and live at higher temperatures. How many generations? One generation. Didn't change the DNA itself, changed markers on the DNA, and that's why this change is called an epigenetic response. It doesn't say genetic response, epi, which means above the genes. It's a marker that operates above the genetic level. Epigenetics. Wow, that's kind of cool. Here's another one. I might have talked about this before too. Parental olfactory experience influences behavior, neural structures, and subsequent generations. Okay, you obviously a mouse there, and you see little mouse pups in this particular case. So what they're looking for on this is they're looking for evaporating odor molecules, and it's actually got a specific sensor specific for cherry blossom odor. What they did here, and I might have told you this, they took these male mice, the poor guys, glutton for punishment, and they put them on a metal pad, and the metal pad could shock their feet painfully. Not electrocute them, just hurts them bad on their feet. That's sad. That's what happens when you get to be a biologist and go off to college and work on a PhD. Anyway, and then they expose these mice to cherry blossom odor, and they shock their feet. They expose them, and they shock them, expose them, and shock them. Shock, shock, shock. All right. Then they take these male mice, and what do you think they do? They mate them with females who have never had their feet shocked. And then she has pups. And then they sacrifice the pups immediately upon birth, before they can smell anything, and they stain them in the olfactory region. So you have mouse nasal tissue stained, and they're looking for olfactory bulbs and the nerves on that. And this is what they found. This is the olfactory tissue on a little pup mouse. And here are the bulbs, olfactory bulbs, and the nerves stained blue. They're stained blue. Here are the controls. And here are the offspring of the dads whose feet were shocked. And they have olfactory bulbs and nerves with over a 200% increase. And those olfactory bulbs are specific for, guess what? Cherry blossom odor. This was also an epigenetic change. Now, these things, when you were in school, we're taught were never going to happen. You can't get these environmental changes to change your germ cells, egg or sperm, in one generation. And yet it's happening in one generation. So these pups are born sensitized to cherry blossom odor. Why? Because as far as the pups know, and they don't know anything, dad lives in a bad environment. And you would want to be sensitive to that. So they're already sensitized to it before they're ever exposed to it. Wow. In one generation. Here's another one. This one deals with birds. This one doesn't pick on male birds or female birds. They're equal opportunity on that. Chronic exposure to low-dose radiation at Chernobyl favors adaptation to oxidative stress in birds. So, how many remember Chernobyl? It was a nuclear meltdown in Russia in the 1980s. I was in the Navy at the time. I was stationed in Sicily. And some of the radiation came over to Germany, but it never got to Sicily. But everybody was concerned about it. And now you've seen pictures around Chernobyl. The entire reactor's what? Been covered over. Everybody's been evacuated. But they can't evacuate all the animals. So the animals are living in this radiation zone. And you would think that they would either die or not, but they don't die. Well, you would think that they would be deformed or malformed due to radiation exposure causing lots of mutations. They're not malformed. In fact, some of these animals are thriving there, and these birds are able to thrive there. What do you think they're able to detect? They're not detecting the radiation itself. They're detecting markers of tissue that has been damaged by radiation. They're detecting the results of radiation damage, and when they detect the results of radiation damage, the repair mechanisms that they have, which repairs their DNA when it gets damaged naturally, they upregulate the repair mechanisms. So DNA repair mechanisms go into overdrive, fixing DNA damage, and these birds don't live shorter lives compared to their non-exposed birds. They live longer lives because they're repairing all of their DNA more rapidly. It says, thus, when several species are considered, the overall pattern indicates that birds are not negatively affected by chronic exposure to radiation and may even obtain beneficial hermetic effects following an adaptive response. Huh. That's quite remarkable. Quite remarkable. Not all the birds respond the same way. It's actually birds that actually have these bluer colors. Bred birds don't respond as well, but bluebirds do. That's quite remarkable on that. Well, anyway, these organisms have really well adapted. So we've covered several generations there and all different kinds. Now let's look at a couple fish. This one is a fish. Mechanisms underlying adaptation to life in hydrogen sulfide-rich environments. How many of you know what hydrogen sulfide gas is? Smells like what? Rotten eggs. Hydrogen sulfide. It's released from sometimes when oil wells are drilling, they let off a little hydrogen sulfide gas as well on that. Hydrogen sulfide gas will dissolve in water, and normally you don't like living in that. It makes it acidic and other things like this. Well, these fish are living quite happily in some streams in Mexico where these streams have been polluted with hydrogen sulfide toxins. So if it's hydrogen sulfide, what do you think they have a sensor for? Hydrogen sulfide. Believe it or not, they have a sensor for hydrogen sulfide. Where might you put the sensor if you were a fish designer If you're a fish designer and you wanted these fish to be able to detect it really quickly, where might you put the sensors? You could put it on their skin. They'd be exposed to a lot of hydrogen sulfide there. Where do they get a lot of water flow?
Through their
gills. So you would put this hydrogen sulfide sensor on their gills, and that's where it is on that. And when they detect that, there's a change in their genes, the change in the expression of their genes. I mentioned yesterday that most of the traits that we have are polygenic, which means multiple genes affect one trait, one gene can affect multiple trait. Well, as you can see here, the fish even change shape. This is the non-hydrogen sulfide exposed. This is what they look like when they've been exposed to hydrogen sulfide. They morph into a different shape, and certain genes are upregulated and certain genes are downregulated. How many genes on average upregulated? Over 1,600 genes, and over 1,800 are downregulated in this response to the hydrogen sulfide. Not a gene. You know, all of us think about the gene. Well, I got the gene for this. You know, some of you have kids and you say, well, my kid's got the smart gene and the other kid's got the dumb gene or something. No, parents don't say that, all those kinds of things. But, you know, I had patients who came in and said, you know, my brother got the skinny gene and I got the fat gene or stuff like that. That's not true. There's not a gene for one particular thing. It's multiple genes which are changing expression based on their exposures. And the paper says this. It's not that they are necessarily turning on some other unrelated genes. It's really that the genes that have been previously implicated in hydrogen sulfide detoxification are turned on or turned up. Which means this. They have genes which keep hydrogen sulfide out. Those are upregulated. They have genes which cause the fish to excrete hydrogen sulfide faster. They're upregulated. And they have genes in their liver which help to detoxify it. They're upregulated. So they're all change enabling these fish to live in this specific environment. And then I know I've talked about this one. This is the blind cave fish. And the question is, obviously, they're able to detect something when they turn into a cave to go from a pigmented, sighted fish to a non-pigmented, unsighted fish. And I know I mentioned this because we talked about with Pastor today that they're able to do this in one generation. And they're able to detect when they're in the cave. And they're able to detect water conductivity. I mentioned that last time. And the paper asks this. A critical question, however, is whether a river fish finding itself suddenly trapped in a cave environment would experience a heat shock protein 90 related stress response. And the answer was yes. And these fish can have reduced eyes within one generation. Rapidly generate on that. Quick response. Does that make sense? Of course it does. If you found yourself suddenly trapped in a cave, you couldn't survive for many, many, many generations until you lost your eyes. You have to have a mechanism which can detect that and change you very, very rapidly. This is another one. Rapid, large-scale, evolutionary divergence. How about if we just replace those words with adaptation? A rapid, large-scale adaptation in morphology and performance associated with exploitation of a different dietary resource. Well, what do you think animal this they're studying here? Lizards. They're studying lizards off an island in Greece. And what these lizards underwent was a change in their diet. These lizards were primarily insect eaters, but when they got transferred to the island, this other island in Greece, the insects that they ate were gone, and these lizards started eating plant material instead of the insects. So nobody knows exactly what they have their sensors for. They suspect it's plant material on those things. But guess what they developed? This is quite remarkable. Now you're looking at lizard intestines here. And the lizards, which were not eating plants, did not have a cecum or a cecal valve. But when these lizards were transferred to the other island, just like the gland on the seagulls, they formed a cecum and cecal valve de novo in their gut. Why? What does the cecum do? It holds plant material, allows it to be broken down by the bacteria so that you can absorb the nutrients through the rest of the intestine on it. A whole new structure. Now, where was the information to do that? Did it happen by random mutations? No, because it happens rapidly. In fact, they don't know how fast this happened. It happened in less than 40 years when they went back and somebody decided to open one up and found these cecal valves there. The information to do this was already in these lizards. They had the ability to do this right from the beginning because the Lord Jesus made these creatures with the ability to be what? Fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. And that means whether you eat the insects or whether you eat the plants, it's able to do this. Now, whether all these creatures can do it or not, I don't know. And then finally, that was pretty large scale right here. Large scale diversification without genetic isolation in nematode symbionts of figs. Okay, I'll explain this. This is large scale change. This is the nematode, otherwise known as a worm. This is obviously magnified many times. This worm is microscopic. And the worm is passed through this vector, which is a wasp. And the wasp will land on these figs, and the worm then is excreted by the wasp, and it drills its way into the figs, and it lives off the fruit, off the nutrients inside of these figs. Now, it all depends on what kind of fig it lands on and what specific wasp transfers it. Because based on those different changes, you can get 5 different types of the nematode when it develops from a single cell. And this is what it mentions. This is developmental plasticity, and it's showing the micrograph here of one type of nematode and the other. And the 5 different ones would not even be in the same genus if you were to see them independently, yet they're all genetically identical to each other. Wow. The paper says this is macroevolutionary scale diversification. You know what macroevolution is? That means one kind of creature to another kind of creature. That's what macroevolution is. Macroevolutionary scale diversification without genetic divergence. Given the empty niche conditions predisposing an ecosystem to the trophic diversification of its colonist. In other words, if you were to just see these nematodes under a microscope, you would not know that they were even related to each other. They have changed so much. But if you were to sequence their DNA, they would be genetically identical to each other. All depending on the wasp vector and what figs they mature on. Wow, that's quite remarkable. And so my poster talk, which I would have done in 10 minutes, we took a little bit longer, demonstrates that these organisms are continuously tracking environmental changes over all of these different generations, all of these different generations within their own lifetime. And those mechanisms can be characterized as what? Regulated. In fact, we should say highly regulated. Highly regulated, rapid, repeatable, and reversible. And it happens as a spectrum from very fast to multiple generations. And they're doing it through the sensors, the logic mechanisms, and the output responses. Well, that wraps my lecture for tonight on this. Hopefully that's a game changer. Hopefully that changes your perspective on adaptation altogether. The next time someone comes up to you talking about random mutations and natural selection, you'll just laugh under your breath and say, I know how these organisms are really doing it. Pastor, turn it back to you.